The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okay, what I want to do is have a bit of a discussion on the book, and then interface with that some listening and some reflections on what we hear, so that we may react or interact in an informed way with the theses of the book, and see where that takes us. What is, in a nutshell, the thesis of Peter Kivi's book, Music Alone? Can anybody attempt to just simply summarize what his basic philosophy is? There's a lot of material, there's a lot of rabbit trails, and he takes a lot of excursions, but he does have a central notion. Lisa didn't see it. But does anybody... Well, give me some hints. Anybody got a notion of why he wrote the book? Why the title? It's pretty good.
Story.
That's good. No, that's also pretty well the finish. Now, when you say music alone, when he says music alone, what is he talking about? Is he talking about a historical phenomenon?
Purely instrumental.
Which
had no program.
No music. Right.
Designated.
So he's certainly not speaking of all music, right? No. And that's important, because you could easily come back at him and say, hey, wait a minute, what about Gregorian chant, or what about a lullaby or something? He's speaking of a very specialized, in fact, in terms of the history of the world, rare form, which is pure music, pure instrumental music without a lot of help from text and so forth. Now, things, of course, are not so simple, because the big question is there such a thing? And then, if you can answer that question, what does it do? And Helen said it, its main value, as opposed to being representational and all the others, is that it is cognitive. What does that mean? That's a loaded word. What does it mean that music has a cognitive value?
By your mind.
The mind is very much involved. Does that exclude emotions, according to him?
No, I think just the music.
Okay, that's good. Let me show you a couple of places where he really focuses on his thesis, and then let's unpack it, as we like to say around here. Page 67, he's just been describing the problem of the stimulation theory, and he gets to Helen's way. I know you picked this up. He has that Forster quote. Pretty interesting. Helen is the person who sees a lot of things in music, shipwrecks and clouds. And now, when he concludes on this, he says at the very last paragraph, just like you're pointing out, it's a false dilemma. We can construe music alone as an object for the mind without at the same time having to construe it as representational or propositional object in order, as it were, to legitimate its intellectual pretensions. Music alone is of the mind and of the world. It's not about the world or about anything else except perhaps itself. That, I think, is one of his, is probably his central beginning point. Music is about itself, and so it's not primarily a description of something else. Now, when you get to describing how that's possible, you have to You have to flesh it out by saying, well, how can it be about itself if I'm hearing it? What's my reaction to it? On page 78, the first full paragraph, towards the bottom of the paragraph, he says that his claim is this, that when someone is enjoying music, he or she is, in any given instance, enjoying some sonic quality of a piece of music perceived under a certain description as doing something the listener enjoys, as doing something beautifully. Now, what does he mean by that? What is he trying to assert, and as opposed to what? That music out there is not alone, is it? No. Okay, I think they're painting the... Imagine a course in music being disturbed by music.
It's not pure music.
No, it isn't. It's not music alone.
It's
yeah, it's about something. Okay, first of all, who's Margaret?
I couldn't find Margaret. I lost her at the beginning.
Okay, she can only see the music, Margaret.
Oh, okay.
What a person who sees music is intellectual about it, and how do they claim to be enjoying music? Okay, well, Margaret is a person who knows a lot about music and who approaches music by reading scores, by noticing contrasts, by this particular example here. Are you familiar with the fugue form and the stretto and all that stuff? Would get some kind of intellectual satisfaction from what the composer is doing in the stretto. However, he's saying that a non-musician or a non-specialist or a non-Margaret enjoys the music just as much by describing it or under some kind of description, even though it's not academically complicated, even though it's not purely intellectual. His claim is, therefore, when you listen to music, there's a little descriptive process that goes on in your brain or in your heart. You say to yourself, I'm listening to this music, it's affecting me. You don't say it out loud, and it's not even articulated, but there's something that happens that is cognitive. It is perception. And the enjoyment of it is not by simply bypassing this cognitive reception. If you enjoy the sonic quality of a piece, it's under a certain description. Nevertheless, it is beautiful for as much. No, but he says a lot about the way people articulate things. In his favorite thing that he talks about a lot is chercher le thème, find the theme. And in the fancy word for that is heuristics. Heuristics means puzzle solving or the enjoyment of an adventure. And writers will tell you that part of the enjoyment of a good piece of literature is that it builds up your expectations and then leads you down a path that might be different from what you were expecting, but then brings you back and so on. That, in other words, it makes of you a puzzle solver. It makes of you an adventurer, like walking down a path and seeing wonderful things. You don't know ahead of time what's going to greet you there. You've kind of anticipated it, and then you might be surprised or whatever. So he's saying that in the chercher le thème, and find the theme, is what everybody does when they listen to music, whether consciously or not. When you look at a painting, somebody who doesn't know much about art will say, I see a tree. Somebody who knows a lot about art will say, look at the way that light is contrasted to background lighting, or something like that. And the same cognitive process is going on. Again, this can be inarticulate, not articulate. But it's very much part of how we perceive things. On 196, one last little thing here. On 196, at the top, Why then need we seek any further for an explanation of why a composer wishes to combine a joyous subject with an anguished counter-subject? Music alone is a quasi-syntactic structure of musical properties, some of which are describable in phenomenological terms. Yeah, I will. That among the phenomenological properties are expressive ones makes this quasi-syntactic structure more interesting to human beings, but not semantic in any but an adulatory sense of meaningful. That is unhappily misleading. That sentence would qualify, you know, the New Yorker has these things on block that metaphor or what. What he's basically saying here is that music is like a language. So we've talked about that. And being like a language means that there is a syntactical or semantic part of music. But unlike a language, or maybe unlike only reducing music to language, there are phenomena, there are things, there are properties, states of affairs in music. It might be a dense chord, or a loud sound, or a meaningful rhythm, or whatever it might be. And these can be described, and they can be noticed. And some of these are expressive. Some of these have to do with expression, which he means emotion. Now, not only what he calls garden variety emotions, fear, you know, but special, musical, purely musical emotions, aesthetic emotions. And so here his statement is that these phenomena in the language of music are there because we're human, and we respond to things that give us meaning. Not in an adulatory sense of meaningful, not just saying, oh my, this is deep, this is my favorite, this is, you know, but in the sense that of just heuristics, just to have an adventure, a discovery. And he says, to go on, there are musical structures stuffed with expressive properties, such as Brahms' First Symphony. And Esther had the kindness to bring that along, so we'll listen to it if we get a chance a little later. And musical structures where such properties are absent or irrelevant, like the stuff outside there. And in the case of Brahms, we must seek musical understanding not in extra musical interpretations of the expressive property, but in the work viewed as a structure. And there's no magic formula, no philosopher's stone for doing so. Indeed, it's not a philosopher's job to do or tell others how it's done. Okay, does a world view, or does a picture begin to emerge from his from what you've seen here? And if so, how would you evaluate it as a Christian? What can you tell what he's wrestling with? Can you see what he's trying to preserve? And does he come at it from a Christian perspective in the final analysis? I know it's kind of a big question. Let me ask it this way. Do Christians sometimes respond like Mrs. Munt, Helen, Margaret, Tibby, instead of like Christians? Or is it the same thing? You should have a bit of insight here from just simply what we've looked at in the course before. But he's definitely trying to do a couple of things here, and he's trying to protect music from various abuses. Yeah, I'd just be interested to hear what you think.
I don't blame.
Yeah, don't interrupt, right?
I have a lot of
reaction to this.
Okay.
Which, I mean, could become a kind of monologue.
Esther, don't. That's just fine. Go for it.
First of all, it seems quite clear.
That's it.
Okay.
I might be way off base with that.
No, I think you're not way off. I think there is a part, you've got the first part of what he's trying to do absolutely right. He's trying to avoid program or representational explanations of music. But I don't sense that he, for that reason, for as much as he has a program, he has a disdain for program music, says that music is alone. I had the sense that he does relate it to the rest of the world. He won't tell you, you know, as a philosopher, how to do that. But his enjoyment of a piece is not isolated from his being a human being and his relating music to the rest of life. I'm trying to find a place here where he says something like that, and I've forgotten exactly. That's one place. Yep. But also he, you know, when he's criticizing the representational guys, he says that doesn't mean that it's not related to the rest of life. In fact, he takes Jacques Barzan, somewhat to task for saying, well, it's just, you know, it's irrelevant.
But you didn't ask him about whether he's relating it to life, but mm-hmm.
Okay, I asked you to evaluate as a Christian. And so as a Christian, you know, you'd want to, of course, you'd want to say that he's not one and he's far from it. But wouldn't you also want to see certain things that he's trying to defend, which we, for our own reasons, would also want to defend?
Yes. Yeah,
that's something that, you know, struck me about this.
I think he's right on the money, basically, on anything.
Yeah. That's right.
He's missing an important link somewhere.
Yeah, like God.
Like God. And here he is, he's using words like ineffable.
Yeah.
Ineffable.
Yeah, mysterious.
Ineffable.
I know that it's so it's so frustrating. Yeah.
Like that. So
I don't know if he would say that, but
there's a caveat to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what's unexplainable and undefensible, it seems.
Mm-hmm. On his basis.
His own, sort of
absolutely.
Argument.
He reminds me, and I think he's probably coming from there in some ways, of a Kantian in his aesthetics who has these absolutes, you know, but they're not somehow joined to verifiable reality, or certainly not to revelation. Or the absolute character of God. And where he's not politically correct, because he's not recognizing as much as many, many modern musicologists would want to recognize the different flavors and characterizations that culture gives, as let alone social structure and so on. Because he's trying to say that music is a cognitive phenomenon and it's in a way culturally universal. Now he's admitting that it's a very small part of music that does this, so that's already a cultural thing.
You mean historically?
Yeah, historically. I mean, it's only 300 or 400 years of music that's been this
UFLN
pure.
Music.
Yeah, hell yeah, UFLN music. That's right. Page 90 is interesting. He's talking about the fact that It's quite amusing. It's funny. It's the first time I've ever seen anybody notice this. The first time I saw the game of curling, I saw those sweepers, and I was in hysterics. Those guys, it is so funny. They're sort of going ahead of the stone, and they're sweeping madly, you know, and you know, what are they doing? And he noticed that too. But on page 90, he says, it's the sweepers explanatory program that I've adopted here. I hope to show how the activity of appreciating music alone is more or less modeled by Chef Chedotem and closely related to musical perceptions. I offer no explanation of why such discovery is pleasurable. I see Christians would say, hey. You know. Nor, however, do I want to suggest that the question is illegitimate to ask or recalcitrant to reasoned inquiry. But it's a question and an inquiry, as I see it, for others. My modest goal, rather, is to try to show that the activity of musical appreciation, a cluster of perceivings, that, of which discovery of a theme in the fugue is the paradigm, is agreed on all hands to be the kind of activity that we human beings generally find pleasurable. Why they find it pleasurable? It's an interesting and deep question. On it I stand mute. That silence does not, however, make my explanation of musical enjoyment vacuous or non-existent, for its progress at least to have gotten from curling to tennis. And that is what I have settled for here, which will, I trust, acquit me of the charge of standing mute. So what his very limited goal is to say, you can't reduce music to a stimulus. You can't reduce it to a program. You can't reduce it to intellectual ability to discern themes. But it's only music. And I as a Christian, I believe that in some ways this is quite close to the general transcendental Amsterdam presuppositionalist point of view that we have around here, which says that you can't reduce one part of creation to another, and that you can't absolutize one part of creation at the expense of others, but that each part has its own freedom and its own character. Now, Doyevaert goes very far with this, with his modalities, the biotic. And I'm not quite satisfied with Doyevaert's aesthetic mode, the center of which is what he calls harmony. I'm not sure about that. But what I appreciate very much in Doyevaert is that he sees that each part of the created world is a kind of irreducible sphere that can't be kind of explained away just by words or just by psychology or just by economics or whatever. And music, I think, fits very nicely into that. It is its own world. It has a language. It speaks to us in ways that nothing else can. Therefore, describing it is fine, but you can't reduce it to verbal description. Being stimulated by it is fine, but you can't reduce it to stimulation. Finally, it has a kind of response that only music can evoke. Now, as a Christian, I would have to explain that. I would want to take up where he left off. When he says, I can't explain why it's pleasurable, I think we Christians can say, well, sure, because God made the world this way. He made us in his image. He made music as covenant response. And he's given us a meaning context to set it all in. No, they didn't say that, did they? That's the one he left out. But a lot of Christians have the foot-tapping view or the score-reading view or, the stimulus view. A lot of Christians, instead of chercher le thème musically, would look for the meaning, the non-musical meaning of a piece. Why did Beethoven write this? Well, because he was mad or because he was happy or because his mother... I don't know, some explanation that, because he's born again, or he's not born again, which is racing into connections that can only be made after a lot of time is spent explaining the details. All right, let me do a little exercise. This first example is very familiar, and it's too long, so we might talk a little as we hear it. But it is an example of program music. terrible sound on this. What music? Sunday morning? Would you listen to Sunday morning? All right, first of all, how many people know what this is? One. Okay. It's not a very good recording of it. All right. Well, you have to be quiet for a second. Now, the rest of you, let me just say this, that it is program music. And there's an official story behind it. And let me just ask you, as you listen to it for a bit, if you can tell what the story is. Or even get close, or even get within some sort of approximation. I used to do this with my high school students, the music appreciation, and I got some really interesting answers. I'm sorry about the recording. All right. Now, anybody except Esther have any ideas? Give me a ballpark of what type of thing it might be about. It's really unfair to do this. It's going to prove Kivi's point pretty nicely, I think. I'll tell you, I wrote down some of the ones that some of my high school students used to say. Clouds racing across the sky after a storm. You like it? That might be as much as I recorded. Yep. A passionate emotional experience. Dancers moving across the stage. Okay. Do you remember the story, Esther?
Yes. Is this the second movement?
I think it is the second movement. I was trying to think if it's the second one or the dance one. Is that okay? Because there's what, five, six movements?
Yeah.
It's not a classical symphony.
Well, there's an idée fixe.
Yeah.
That idée fixe is the melody that...
You heard it twice here, and it comes... It's a thread that goes through.
It happens in every single movement, and that idée fixe is a person, and the composer has fallen in love with this woman, and that melody represents her. And in this particular room, I think it's when he first meets him.
It's either that or the one where he's on a drug.
He's on a drug.
Because
he has that drug trip.
Right. So it's the story. This is Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. It's the story of his love affair with this woman, and they meet and they have this passionate love, and then they they break up and he's completely, you know, discombobulated, and he takes drugs and he forgets and then he remembers, there's a quite an elaborate, it takes about three paragraphs to say it, and the symphony is a portrayal of this. Now, now that you know the story, does that make the piece more clear? How would you answer that? No. Would Kivi answer just a straight no? Actually, he actually mentions this somewhere. Let's see if he has it in the index. Kivi, of course, is against program music, but he doesn't... I don't think he just simply says...
I think he does say it has to be reading or has to
be... Yeah. Or knowing anything extra can add to the meaning of it. Well, the one reference to Berlioz isn't it? Yeah, he said, in the case of Berlioz, we have the program. I remember that. I should have reread this. Music alone. Anyway, what he says basically is that having the program, here it is, page 54, top. Two key words are implicit, inarticulate. Of course, the program of Berlioz's Symphony of Kuno's Biblical Sonatas are there for us, for all to see. No argument about that. But where's the program of Beethoven's C-sharp minor quartet, or Bach's Inventions? And there's where he gets to his thing about ineffability. What he's saying is that the program is a piece of the puzzle, but it's a very, very small, unimportant one, one which you can do without in order to get full enjoyment. And here's where he actually, he criticizes Barzan, who's the big defender of Berlioz, at least in the old school. Barzan, he is so anxious to say that music is a complete world in itself, and supplies a program, that he's broadened the definition of program so that absolutely every piece of music has one. And so, to cover all cases, you've got to define it in such a way that it loses its usefulness. So, the fact of having a program is an interesting historical feature, but for music alone, it's not crucial. It's not important. The music has to be able to stand on its own. Does the music lose its value without the program? Should it have to stand on its own to be music? I'm giving you a trick question, I think, because to be music... You know, that there's no one requirement to be music. There's lots of different kinds of music. I would say that the tricky part of it is that music never is alone. It's always surrounded with culture. And whether it's program notes written by Berlioz, or whether it's the fact that you're in a classroom and being asked to think about what a program might be, you're surrounding the music with other things. No one listens to music alone. There isn't any such thing as music alone. That's what he's saying. Music alone is not alone. It always brings in a whole lot of things with it. And so, the value of the Berlioz Symphony, sure, it's beyond the program, but it's never beyond human experience, because humans don't experience music in any other way but by being human. And I think, for that reason, it's kind of a mistake to teach kids about the symphony by playing this piece and saying, now listen to the Edifix, that's the girl. You know, because then they won't be able to listen to the music as a structure. It's there, but that's not, I'm sure, the way Berlioz composed. He didn't think Edifix, girl, drugs, violins, you know. He wrote music, and then the theme was generally there. Now, there is some music that's much more literalistic than that about its themes. And And to the point where some music seems very thin. Score relationships where, you know, if somebody is afraid, the music gets loud. If he's sad, it gets minor. And if that's the only thing there is to the music, it'll be a pretty thin piece of music. But usually there's so much more. I mean, Handel did a great deal of painting in music. Like when he wrote about a mountain, the notes would go da 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 da. Well, pretty obvious. But, you know, Kivi would say, that's fine, but it's not a key to the meaning of it. The key to that thing is not seeing a mountain behind it. The mountain is there, and there's some relationship, but the key is it works musically. It fits. It does what it's supposed to do. It's the whole thing. You cannot reduce the virtue of a piece to a program. Actually, I listened to this piece for many years without knowing the story. Don't know how it happened to me, but I did. And then I guess I picked up a record jacket or something and said, huh, look at that. There's a story behind this. And I enjoyed the music very much without knowing anything about it. I was actually rather disappointed when I found out what the story was. It's hard to listen to it without knowing, without relating it to the story. You know, like there's a movement where it's called, I think the title of the movement is something like To the Scaffold. You know, so he's going to, and when he's hanging, the idée fixe is cut off like that. Well, I can never listen to that without thinking of the guy going to being hanged, and you know, so in a way it's sort of disappointing, but in another way that's one more cultural piece in listening to it.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting that Kivi never
Mm-hmm.
He only talks about representation.
Yeah.
But music sometimes has associations there.
He doesn't, I guess you're right, he doesn't use the term, but I think he kind of uses the concept in his thing about hearing the emotions.
Well, like Elgar's, a prodigal at the pinnacle of their...
Right. Yeah, melancholy and happiness are the fuzz on the peach. Okay, now, do you want a break or do? Because I've got a bit more here. Should we take a little break and then come back to this? Because I want to do another little exercise with you. Cover up my notes so you won't know what's coming next. Because that'll take us well into the second hour. So let's take a pause, and then we'll do more. Listen to this piece. I'm so sorry about this. I've got to redo this. Where's the volume? Oh, volume. I wonder if that means volume.
Thank you.
So we should have a choir do this at graduation. Then we'd be cooking. Yeah. That'd be great. Anybody know what this is?
I thought it was Schoenberg.
No.
Is this
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Stravinsky, yeah.
Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms. Number of reasons it's a significant piece for our discussion. First, I think I've alluded to this before, but Stravinsky in his Poetics of Music, 1938, says that music is pure architecture. It has no associations with human emotions, religiosity, whatever it might be. And he mentions specifically some of the things that people were said about his Symphony of Psalms and other religious pieces as being really off the beam. One reviewer said it had exactly the right combination of modern and Jewish sentiment that you would want to have in a psalm. And Stravinsky says, that's nonsense, I just wrote the music. Here's a great example of where I think a composer is very limited and wrong, whereas the music is very significant beyond what he realized. I mean, we've been told this a lot in critical hermeneutics and deconstruction, and so forth, to the point where some people actually disdain the author. But in this case, I think the author is seriously in error in his theory about what happened in the music.